we have discussed the power of the will, the power of the word, the power of the cross, and the power of forgiveness. I think it was important for us to talk about the power of forgiveness because we all need it, don't we? And what does the Lord's Prayer say? Forgive us in the same manner we forgive other people. So the standard by which we judge other people and the standard by which we accord forgiveness apparently becomes the standard by which we are then forgiven. And so for a lot of good reasons, it's important to learn this vital lesson. And I know it's a hard lesson to learn. I know it is not easy to see truth damaged, to see wrong done, to be wronged yourself, to have atrociously false things said about you. I know that from experience. It's very hard to handle that and imitate the example of Jesus. Nevertheless, that seems to be an essential ingredient of our growth in Christ. And maybe that stumbling block alone will account for some stagnation in the Christian pathway as we seek to grow. We get around that one, I think we have a lot of problems solved. And it tends to take the energy out of the system, so wrong doesn't live on. Wrong spins to its own end and dies out. Well, now let's talk about the power of prayer. Now, you folk have all been witness during the last few hours of something which I have often spoken about when I've talked to people and I would use an example of a military doctrine. And that is to say, if you are in the presence of a military enemy and the order is given to attack, one of the first primary objectives against which you strike is what? Enemy communications ability. Now, did we not see that in Iraq? Well, I feel somewhat vindicated. We haven't really been involved in conflict enough since Vietnam that has been apparent in the news, but I've often said that one of the primary objectives is the enemy communications complex, because if the enemy cannot communicate with itself, it is much less able to do you harm. And we saw that happen in Desert Storm. Some of the primary objectives were the Iraqi communications net. We saw that go down. Now, is there a spiritual illustration or analog for that? Yes, there is. Why do you suppose it has been over the last 10 to 15 years that within Adventism we have so often heard second guesses or doubts or second thoughts about the spirit of prophecy, for example? Because if the communication system by which heaven communicates with heaven's church and with God's believers is brought into doubt, and we're not sure we're hearing truth, then do you see how confused the troops become? There's a problem. Now, it's been my experience that when the spirit of prophecy is openly questioned and subject to what is sometimes called higher criticism, inevitably the word follows. And so we've heard some very bright, intelligent people raise a lot of questions about whether the Bible really can be believed. Are there elements of it that we may need to, quote, reinterpret with new truth or new light or new understanding? And what disturbs me about that is that's where the war began. Remember back in Eden, the devil came to Eve and he said, Eve, I don't doubt you read the Bible. I don't doubt you heard God speak. My question is, did you get it right the first time? Did he really mean don't eat this fruit? And if you think so, I ask you to reinterpret what you thought you heard based on this new scientific evidence I can offer you. Here I stand. I've elevated to a new and higher level of existence, and I'm not dead. Higher criticism, making the Bible seem to be wrong simply because superficial truth or superficial facts suggest that, you see. So the communication system is very important in warfare, both earthly and spiritual. Now, what is our communication system with heaven? Well, we've already talked about one element of that, and that's the Word. That's communications coming from God to us. What about the other direction? What about the power of prayer? Let's talk about that this afternoon, and I'd like to, you know, there are many things you could say about this, and I'm only just going to suggest a couple of aspects of this thing that I think are worth our spending a little time looking at. First of all, let's talk about praying when we have a problem. Is there a model in the Bible as to how a prayer is most effective in the face of a great problem? Well, yes, there is. Why don't you turn back to 2 Chronicles chapter 20? 2 Chronicles 20. Here again, by interesting coincidence, we find many, many centuries ago, people on the eve of war in the Middle East. That landscape over there must have been tramped almost to asphalt by armies marching back and forth over the whole history of the human race. We're seeing it again today, and it was happening back in the time of King Jehoshaphat. And 2 Chronicles 20 tells the story. It came to pass after this that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, and with them other beside the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat to battle. And then there came some that told Jehoshaphat, saying, "There cometh a great multitude against thee from beyond the sea." And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Lord. Now what he faces here is a numberless consortium of armies that are coming generally from across the Jordan, out in the land of Moab, out in the area of Mount Seir. The Ammonites were there, very ferocious desert tribes that knew how to fight and didn't know much about mercy and didn't care if they did know. And they're coming in a concerted, enveloping movement toward Jerusalem. And Jehoshaphat has nothing like the kind of force necessary to repel this. In other words, he's facing a problem he can't solve, not humanly. And what is his response? Well, it is the same response that you folk have felt sometimes when a loved one is ill, or you've heard about a problem, or you've had a son or daughter in the military service and things were looking a little bit scary. Or as in the story that Esau told us about allowing a loved one to stay with us a little longer for the sake of the prayer of a young boy who believes that God can do things like that, see? So we've all done that, each in our own way. And Jehoshaphat set himself to seek the Lord, and he proclaimed a fast. Now, what is a fast? Well, it's a time in which, simply through the mechanism of food, you show the Lord that you're more concerned about the problem than you are about yourself. Isn't that right? Can you think of some other things that people have sometimes done in spiritual emergencies besides fasting, when it was just life or death? They really wanted to talk to the Lord, and it was important that they speak with as few impediments as possible. What else has happened in times of spiritual emergency in the Bible? People would fast. What else would they do? Sometimes they would dress a little more simply, wouldn't they? Remember stories like that? It took off jewelry, sure. In other words, they're saying, in easier times, I could perhaps afford the luxury of thinking about self and eating well and dressing a little fancy and maybe hoping people would notice me. But all that is suddenly eclipsed, and it's gone. It no longer matters, because this is life or death. And so people kind of got the ego off the throne and looked to heaven. And is there a possibility that maybe that's the reason why that Adventists, sensing this urgency of an end-time day of atonement and the oncoming final judgment of the world, have stressed that it's no longer our job to do anything to draw attention to self, you see, either in the way we dress or eat or act. Now it's serious business. It's a day of atonement. And things that may have been perfectly acceptable behavior for Christians in other eras are no longer what we want to do in this time of spiritual emergency. Well, they proclaimed a fast throughout Judah. And now verse 5 picks up the story. And Jehoshaphat stood in the congregation of Judah in the house of the Lord and said. Now, here is where the prayer begins. And I'm wondering if you folk can kind of share with me some of the lessons we can learn from the way this man prayed. Verse 5 of 2 Chronicles 20, or actually verse 6 now, as he begins to pray, he said, "O Lord God of our fathers, art not thou God in heaven?" Now he begins the way we all begin. You know, we address God. Well, what's the next thing he says within that very sentence? Our Father who art... All right. Doesn't his prayer kind of remind you of Jesus' prayer? Our Father who art in heaven... See, he says, "O Lord God of our fathers, art now thou God in heaven?" Aren't you in control? and rulest not thou over all the kingdoms of the heathen? What he is doing is kind of Job-like, bringing to the throne of God these questions which say, Lord, aren't you in charge? Is this not the world you've made? Don't you set kings up and take them down? Have you not promised protection to your people, Israel? And look here at the end of verse 6. He says, and in thine hand is there not power and might, so that none is able to withstand thee? He starts reciting what? The qualifications of the person from whom he's seeking help. Now, wait a second. Isn't there something wrong in this picture? Any of you folk get that magazine Highlights for your kids? Okay, and on the back cover of Highlights every month, there's a picture with stuff wrong on it, you know? There's a raccoon ice skating or who knows what, you know? Things are kind of made wrong so that little children can develop the ability to recognize what's correct and what isn't correct. And I kind of think of that as I look at this. Look at the way Jehoshaphat is praying here. Now, this man's got a problem, and he hasn't said anything about it yet. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't I? Oh, Lord! We might say our Father in heaven. We might say that much. Then we'd say, we got a problem here. You know, the children of Moab and Ammon and Mount Seir and all these people are on their way, and we would begin to inform the Lord of the problem. Jehoshaphat doesn't have much time. It doesn't take long to march from where they are to where he is. He's got maybe a couple of days. Isn't there some urgency here? Why would he pray the way he prays here? Why spend time reciting the qualifications of God to do what needs to be done? You ever wonder about stuff like that? Why does he pray that way? Well, when he does, where is his mind focused? On the problem or on the solution? Okay? So he starts in right. And might I suggest that when we pray, it's more important to focus on the solution than on the problem. The Lord knows all about the problem. We can get to that. But first of all, let's talk about the power of God. Now, what do you suppose these words did for Jehoshaphat's faith? See, when you say things, you also hear them, because your ears aren't very far from your mouth. You realize that you hear it before anybody else does? Okay? And when you hear yourself express faith, then what does that do for your faith? Let me ask you a question. Have you ever just had somebody do something just really got under your hide? You know? They didn't like your pecan pie or something, and you knew it was the best in the county. And today's was, believe me, I enjoyed that. I don't get that very often out in California, and I like it. Whatever happens, somebody says something you don't like, and it gets under your hide, and you go and you tell somebody else about it, and as you hear the words coming out, do you feel the anger ratcheting up? You know, when you hear yourself talk about it, it really does a job on you. And pretty soon, you know, a person can stew themselves into a tornado. The more you talk, the more angry you get, and that makes you want to talk. Well, what's this doing for Jehoshaphat's faith? The same principle applies, doesn't it? If he'd gone to the Lord and said, we've got a terrible mess. I don't know how many of them there are. There are conflicting opinions, Lord. Some of them say 100,000, say 200,000. What are we going to do? And pretty soon he's talking about the problem and he never gets the chance to express faith. Instead, he focuses on God's power. And so he increases his own faith. And then, of course, there's just an untold multitude listening to him. How do you suppose they feel when they hear the king saying, speaking to the source of help, and he says, look, you got control over the whole world. You made it. You set kings up. You bring them down. You control the affairs of the heathen, and that increases faith. Now, don't you think that's a better way to pray than the way we sometimes do? Well, I think it is. And he goes on in verse 7, art not thou our God, who didst drive out the inhabitants of this land before thy people Israel, gave it to the seed of Abraham? Goes on and tells all the promises God made, and now only in verse 10 does he finally get around to telling the problem. And now behold the children of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom thou wouldst not let Israel invade. Behold, I say, how they reward us to come out to cast us out of whose possession? Thy possession. Huh? Jehoshaphat is not praying for a vindication of his rights. He's praying for a vindication of the work of God. And there's a big difference there. He didn't say they're going to throw us out of our land, defend our rights. Behold how they reward us to cast us out of thy possession, whom thou hast given. Now here comes the plea. First of all, he's put God first, increased his faith in that of his people. He stated the problem. Now comes his request in verse 12. He's been six verses getting to this. O our God, wilt thou not judge them, for we have no might against this great company. Now there lies the key. We have no way to solve the problem. Now, is there a possibility that we get very little out of prayer because too many times we're asking the Lord to somehow bless our great efforts, you see, and we try to bring our efforts to bear against eeny, meeny, miny, moe? Let's think up something. Let's say temptation, okay? Lord, here comes that temptation. And Lord, help me to whip it. Well, Jehoshaphat was just honest enough to say, Lord, I can't handle it. We have no might. We have no might against this great company that cometh against us. Neither know we what to do, but our eyes are where? Our eyes are upon thee. And I suggest that he was able to conclude his prayer this way because he began his prayer with his eyes on God. Big difference between focusing on your problem and focusing on the power of the Lord. And in that, he admits their absolute helplessness. Now, might there be some value in this as we confront temptations, particularly the big ones that come at you, and you can see them coming from three city blocks away, and the closer they get, the bigger they look, and you recognize that you have never, ever successfully withstood that temptation before, and finally you say, Lord, I know I'm not going to make it. This is the way I think the alcoholic or whatever finally overcomes the problem, that kind of prayer. We have no might against this great company that cometh against us, neither know we what to do, but our eyes are on thee. Now that was the prayer. That's all it took. Now the Lord does sometimes speak through prophets, and he immediately did so here. While that group was standing there in a terrible crisis, much more worried perhaps than we are today in East Texas, because we're not as near the problem as others are in today's world, the Lord responded to that prayer. And here some obscure brother by the name of Jehaziel, the son of Zechariah, stands up, inserts himself into history for just a few verses, and disappears again. He's a nobody coming from nowhere except the Lord chooses to speak through him. And he intrudes briefly into history. And he gives them some advice which doesn't make a lick of sense. What does he say? Hearken, ye all Judah and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem, be not afraid nor dismayed by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but whose? God's. Tomorrow go ye down against them. Then he gives them the valuable military information they seek, the kind of thing we spend millions of dollars on satellites and reconnaissance and code-breaking machines to get where they're going to be tomorrow. And he gives it to them. By the way, you remember back when, who was it? Elisha. Wasn't it Elisha? Had healed Naaman. Have I got it right? Elijah's gone by this time, isn't he? And Elisha heals Naaman, and Naaman goes back to Syria, and the king of Syria is worried. He says, every time I make a military plan, Israel is there. Block, block, block. Check and mate. I can't get by them. Somebody here is telling the king of Israel what my plans are. And you, as well as I know, how few of us there are in this room. It has to be one of you. Somebody stands up and says, that's not one of us. There's a prophet in the land. And I'm convinced that the individual who told that to the king of Syria was Naaman. Who else would have known better? He's a general-in-chief. He's captain of Syria's host. And so the Lord, you see, when the Lord is on your side and your life is right with the Lord, you're capable of getting the kind of help that even the advanced technology of today's military struggles to get. And this man stands up and he says, they'll be here at a certain time. Ye shall find them at the end of the brook before the wilderness of Jeruel. You shall not need to fight in this battle. Set yourselves, stand ye still, and see the salvation of whom? Of the Lord. Now, what we're talking about here, much more than just a story out of ancient Israel, is the whole drama of righteousness by faith acted out successfully in human lives. That's what we're really talking about here. This is righteousness by faith. You see sin coming, you see temptation, you see failure coming, you first of all, you pray to the Lord in a way that puts Him on the throne instead of your problem. Then you explain the problem to Him as best you can and you leave it with Him and say, Lord, I can't handle it. My eyes are upon Thee. And the Lord responds through all this great mass of help He's given us in the form of inspired writings, and He gives us guidelines for our lives. Finally, He says, you don't need to fight. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Now, did this people at that particular time believe what they were hearing? There would have been every reason not to. What they got from the Lord's prophet makes no sense militarily. It makes none whatever. They are in a fortified position. In Jerusalem, at least they have a few square feet of granite between them and opposing force. They might just be able to last it out. Go out through the city gates and you're in an exposed position with no defensive perimeter whatever. You go out into the presence of an overwhelmingly superior enemy force and you have no place to hide. Now, that doesn't make military sense. Doesn't make anything that I ever learned in any of the staff courses that I took as a military officer. And furthermore, not only do you go out there unprotected and unprepared, but you go out with a choir in front of you that lets them know from 20 miles distant where you are. Now, you don't do that, humanly speaking. That's called faith with capital letters, isn't it? You really believe the battle's already over with. And by the way, in the process of this particular thing, Jehoshaphat says those immortal words about the gift of prophecy. Hear me, O Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem, believe in the Lord your God, so shall ye be established. Believe His prophets, so shall ye prosper. Now, why do we over and over again make a game out of fighting spiritual Vietnams where we go up against the enemy with one hand tied behind our back? And when you don't believe the spirit of prophecy, that's what you're doing, and it's your right hand if you're right-handed. See? If the Lord has been pleased to give us advance information on where the enemy will be, and we have that in the spirit of prophecy because it tells where temptation comes from, where it will be, and how to avoid it, we've already got this return communication from heaven. Why not listen to it and make the job a little easier? I don't understand why we want to fight a spiritual Vietnam and repeat the mistakes that we learned militarily then. You don't fight a war with one hand behind you. You either fight to win or you get out of it, one of the two. But you don't stay Laodicean. Lukewarm people don't go anywhere. See, that's the point. And so Jehoshaphat picked up on that. He said, believe the Lord your God, so shall ye be established. Believe His prophets, so shall ye prosper. And the choir went before the army. And what were they doing? Look at verse 21 of 2 Chronicles 20. He appointed singers to the Lord that they should praise the beauty of what? Holiness. Folk, there is nothing wrong with holiness. And it makes me sad to see reasoned and sometimes highly technical theological discussions telling us why holiness is out of date. Well, it wasn't then, and I don't think it is now. They should praise the beauty of holiness as they went out before the army. So the choir's in the lead. What they're essentially doing is saying we've already won the war, we're already celebrating. Now, isn't that a neat way to handle your own problems? Take them to the Lord. You know, focus on Him rather than your problems. Leave your problem with the Lord. Admit to Him you can't handle it. Tell Him your eyes are upon Him, and then celebrate the victory. And it has to come, you see. Now, in this instance, how many days did it take them to carry off the spoils of that vast army? 3 whole days. So not only did they survive in a physical sense, they were immeasurably enriched, and I guess that kind of is a fulfillment of Jehoshaphat's statement about believing the prophets and prospering, right? How many of those soldiers had to draw a sword in defense of their lives? Not a one. The enemy fell on itself. Now that, folks, is Armageddon. Don't have time to get into that tonight, but go into the Hebrew studies of this thing with respect to the word Gideon. Gedud means a band. A band of soldiers, and over again in the Bible, when the heathen kind of come together in a band, they have a sort of alliance, you know, a military alliance, and they try to encircle the people of God, what happens repeatedly? They fight among themselves, just like the Midianites did with Gideon, just like this alliance of heathen nations did in the time of Jehoshaphat, and you will find that repeatedly. And I think that's Armageddon. I think at the end of time, Armageddon is a great spiritual battle in which the whole world unites against the people of God, and it will end when they fight among themselves. And we'll talk about that this afternoon off the record when we talk about the Middle East. Okay? So there is the kind of way you pray for yourself. Well, now let's be real brief here and go on. What about praying for other people? What about praying for your church? What about intercessory prayer? Power of prayer. To get a biblical view of that, I suggest we go over to the life and times of Daniel 9. And now we see something very interesting here. You see, Babylonia, so to speak, the Babylonian Empire is off the stage of history. It has been replaced with the Medo-Persians. And Daniel 9 picks up with that. The first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, the Mede, was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. Now, something very significant has happened here. First of all, the Persians and the Medes were not like the Babylonians. The Babylonians would worship anything. You know, they had just temples to everything all over the place. Bel, of course, was the big one. They had the big temple of Bel at one end of that big bridge that crossed the river, and the king's palace on the other. But they had a plurality of gods. They worshipped a lot of different gods. The Medes and Persians were not like that, generally speaking. It is my understanding that they believed in one true God. They didn't have the clear view of it that the Hebrew people did, but they believed in one God. And furthermore, they didn't believe in idols. Babylonians loved idols. You could see those bas-relief creatures all across their walls, you know, even today in the museums where they worshipped all these bizarre-looking creatures, winged lions and so forth. Persians did not worship idols. They believed in a true God somewhere. They just didn't quite know how to put it together. Now, in that context, do you think the time is therefore right politically for the Hebrews to go and say, we want to go back and rebuild the temple to the one true unseen God? Sure, the stage of politics is set. It's time for God's people to go home. And Daniel could see that. So Daniel looks at the world around him, at the political world, and he says, I see things of significance happening here. And that's why I suggest that you and I as Adventists ought to be intelligent citizens of our country and of our world and watch what's going on, because it's prophecy playing out before you. You might as well watch it, folks, because you're going to wind up living it. See? Watch it intelligently. Understand what's going on, and don't make the mistake of being too speculative about interpreting prophecy in advance. Because it'll fool you every time, or almost every time. But as prophecy is fulfilled, then you begin to get a clear picture of how prophecy is taking place in today's world. So, like Daniel, I think you and I have the obligation to watch CNN or whatever it is you like to watch, read the newspapers, and look at the world around you and say, how does that fit together with the Bible, with the spirit of prophecy, and with my view of the coming of Jesus? Well, that wasn't all Daniel did. What else did he do? Look at verse 2 of Daniel 9. In the first year of his reign, I understood by books the number of years whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, the prophet. What's he doing? Daniel is studying the Bible, isn't he? Studying prophecy. Now, he might have said, I don't know what I need to study prophecy for. The Lord's spoken through me. I've talked with Gabriel. You know, but he doesn't say that. He reads the Word, doesn't he? One time, a long, long time ago now, several years ago, an attorney in California who had been actively involved in working with a gentleman who had become quite critical of the spirit of prophecy challenged me with this idea. What do we need a spirit of prophecy for? We all have a pipeline to heaven. We all have inspiration. What do we need a spirit of prophecy for? And I said, well, I'll answer that one if you'll answer one for me. Are you a Christian and do you witness? Well, yeah, I did. I said, why? If you don't need the Bible and the spirit of prophecy, we've all got a pipeline to heaven, then what does your neighbor need with you? He's got the same pipeline. Doesn't make any sense. Why would you witness? What do you have to say that he doesn't already know? Because he's also got a channel to heaven, see? And so sometimes these things occur like this. We could say, why would the prophet Daniel need to study the Word? I guess for the same reason Jesus did. And he understood by books the number of years, and he obviously was reading Jeremiah, what we now call Jeremiah 25. That's the chapter in Jeremiah that talks about 70 years of captivity for the people of God. So you see what Daniel's doing now is what a lot of Adventists do. And I suppose if I had kept them all, I probably would have one of the world's most complete list of prophetic charts, because where I go, a lot of people share their prophetic charts with me. And I applaud this. This is good for people to be studying the Word and drawing these lines and figuring things out. Now, all the charts don't agree, but that's all right, too, because it shows that there's a plurality of opinion and people are studying for themselves, you see. Well, Daniel probably was doing that, see? He says, I see the world around me ready for something big. Probably the hair was standing up on the back of his neck like mine is when I read today's news. Something's trying to happen here, folk. If you can't see the coming of Jesus trying to be born, you wouldn't see a Mack truck in front of you. It's trying to happen. Daniel sees it. He goes into the Word. He says, yeah, this all fits. Prophecy says it's time for God's people to go home. Well, he takes one more look around him, and what else does he see? He sees history ready. The Persians are ready. Prophecy is ready. What isn't ready? God's people, right? There's no big hurry here. It'll happen when it happens. He'll come in His good time, not ours. And hopefully not before the BMW at least has 3 or 4 years on it, you see. Well, we have people in California who assure me that the Lord's coming is no big concern of ours, that it will happen when it happens, and I shouldn't worry about trying to hasten that day. And then I fall back on Peter's exhortation to work for and hasten that day, and I feel a little better. But Daniel looks at that, and he says, the church isn't ready. And what does he do? He prays. And he prays for the church that has failed in its mission. Now look at verse 3 of Daniel 9. I set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer, with supplications, fasting, and sackcloth. Isn't that interesting that Daniel does the same thing here that we were talking about earlier? Fasting, taking off all the fancy robes, and I'm sure as prime minister of this new world empire, Daniel has plenty of nice clothes to wear. Puts on sackcloth, in other words, and ashes. There is nothing he's going to do to draw attention to self, because this is a spiritual emergency. And verse 4 says, I prayed unto the Lord my God and made whose confession? Mine. Now, does anybody here know of any place in the Bible where there are sins of Daniel recorded? Imagine he did some. He's a human being, but we don't find any worth putting in the holy book, do we? Huh? Anybody know of any sins of Daniel? I haven't been able to find any. But isn't it interesting he makes his confession? In other words, it isn't we, they. It isn't, Lord, here's your holy servant Daniel. Look at that failing church. What a shame. Right in there with them, isn't he? Right in there with them. Prayed my confession and said, oh Lord, the great and dreadful God, we have sinned. Now, how had they sinned? What were the mistakes that Israel had made? Well, look here in verse 5. Even by departing from thy precepts, that's breaking the law, and verse 6, neither have we hearkened unto thy servants, the prophets. You with me there in Daniel 9, verses 6 and 7? Or verses 5 and 6, rather? What were the two mistakes of Israel? Hadn't followed the law and hadn't followed the prophets. Could you use the term spirit of prophecy there to encompass the spirit which causes prophets to write? And were you to do that, could you find an analog for this in the New Testament? Does Revelation 12:17 say, the dragon was wroth with the woman, went to make war with the remnant of her seed which have the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus, which Revelation 19:10 says is the spirit of prophecy. Don't you find it interesting that Satan is attacking the law and the gift of prophecy at the very end of time, and that's the very same problem Daniel was facing here several centuries before the birth of Jesus. Isn't it interesting how the more things go on, the more they stay the same? The devil really has a program which, with minor variations, is the same old thing. Avoid the law, avoid the gift of prophecy. So Daniel says, we have departed from thy precepts, we have not hearkened unto thy servants, the prophets. O Lord, righteousness belongeth unto thee, but unto us confusion of face. Yea, verse 11, yea, all Israel have transgressed. In other words, it's an apostate church being prayed for. And there may be a lesson in that for us. It's been my experience that people who love the truth and love the word and the spirit of prophecy and so forth find it very hard to see wrongdoing anywhere, but especially when the church fails. It's very hard to see that. It could be very easy to become kind of negative or bitter or critical. But I think the lesson to Daniel is an extremely important one, isn't it? He lumps himself with the church which has failed. He says, all Israel have transgressed. And then he prays for God's blessing on that entity. Now, you remember, after Jesus went back to heaven, in the times of Acts 1 and 2, where did Jesus say to tarry? Tarry ye in where? Jerusalem, which is the sancta sanctorum of the church which had taken his life. Go right back into my church. That's my agency on this earth. And I think it's important for us to remember that. Church may make mistakes, but the Lord's supreme regard is still with it. And it's our duty more than anything to pray for it. Now, I see in Daniel 9 an intercessory prayer. We won't take time to go through all the verses. You should read those in every translation you can get your hands on, because you'll see different views of truth. But over and over again, he openly confesses the failure of God's people, and then he prays for mercy. And look at verse 16. O Lord, according to all thy righteousness, I beseech thee, let thine anger and thy fury be turned away from thy city, Jerusalem. Now therefore, O Lord our God, hear the prayer of thy servant. Cause thy face to shine upon thy sanctuary that is desolate. And then the prayer that heaven can't resist. Listen to it in verse 18. O my God, incline thine ear and hear, and open thine eyes and behold our desolation, and the city which is called by thy name. For we do not present our supplications before thee for our righteousness, but for thy great mercies. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, hearken and do. For thine own sake and for thy people are called by thy name. Now, I submit that when a man or woman of God prays like that, heaven can't resist. Quite evident they couldn't hear, because when he opened his eyes and got off his knees, he's not alone in the room. Who's there? None other than mighty Gabriel himself, highest angel in heaven. Well, I suppose if you wanted to do something just a little bit fun, you could time how long it takes to read that prayer, and within probably a few seconds, you would have the equivalence of how long it would take to say that in Hebrew. That's the flight time between heaven and earth at high speed. Doesn't take him long to get here, does it? And then and only then did Gabriel give Daniel the key that unlocked the 2300-day prophecy. You understand that? He's been puzzled over this thing for 12 years. Can't figure it out. He's worried sick about it. He knows something awful lies in the future. There's this time that he cannot understand that looks like 2300 years, during a large portion of which error will triumph and truth will be trampled. And he's worried sick that it might be that the coming of Messiah will be delayed that long. And Gabriel comes to him finally and he says, here's the key, Daniel. Here's how it all fits together. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. In the midst of the week, Messiah comes. And now Daniel gets the key to the prophecy that mathematically tells you with absolute certainty that Jesus is who he said he was. And only after Daniel acted as an intercessor for God's people was he Christ-like enough, apparently, to pick up on that point. And I find that fascinating. Now, with that in mind, and with the words of Daniel 9, 17, 18, and 19 ringing in your ears, may I invite your attention to the writings of the Spirit of Prophecy, Gospel Workers, page 19. Jesus sees his true church on the earth. He hears their prayers presented in contrition and power. And omnipotence cannot resist their plea. for the salvation of any tried, tempted member of Christ's body. Let's read a couple more, because the power of prayer is something we really haven't used to advantage. Christ Object Lessons, page 206. Never a prayer is offered, however faltering. Never a tear is shed, however secret. Never a sincere desire after God is cherished, however feeble. But the Spirit of God goes forth to meet it. Even before the prayer is uttered or the yearning of the heart is made known, grace from Christ goes forth to meet the grace that is working upon the human soul. It's time to rediscover the mighty power of prayer.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra with outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.